Barry Harris is in the studio with me now. Let me tell you a little bit about him. He has played with Yusef Lateef through the years from about 1951 through 1970. At around 1960, he joined the Cannonball Adderley group after Bobby Timmons left as the piano player. He also joined Max Roach's group after Clifford Brown and Richie Powell passed away unexpectedly. He's also played with Coleman Hawkins. Right now, he's presently the house pianist for the new jazz label Xanadu Records, which was started in about 74 or 75, I think, by Don Schlitten. How did you join up with Xanadu?
Well, you know, Don Slinton and I have been associated so long, you know. He's been the A&R man on about all the last 10 or 15 albums I've been on, you know, with different people. So we're sort of tight. So he formed his label and I went with him, you know.
I have a lot of respect for his productions because they're always free from commercial veneer.
Don is a true jazz lover. You have to hear him talk about when he was a kid going down listening to Bird and stuff, you know. So, and it's been pretty good too because we just took some of the stars from Xanadu and we just come back from a trip to Japan, you know.
What kind of places did you play in Japan?
Just all beautiful places. Well, you know, it was like from city to city. So many cities, you know, Tokyo, Osaka, Kyoto, Kanazawa, Niigata, Fukuoka, Sendai. And see, we played concerts, all Steinway pianos, beautiful halls.
That doesn't happen very often over here, does it?
Well, I tell you, Japan was like that period. There's a lot of things happen in Japan that doesn't happen over here. You know, like being greeted. It's really weird being greeted by a beautiful lady with a bouquet of roses and flowers and, well, you know, photographers and people asking for autographs. It's such a gas.
So you were well known when you arrived?
I tell you, it was so shocking to me. It was like I was living in a little dream, you know.
Do the record stores in Japan carry Xanadu records?
Yes. They carry a whole lot. Those people probably know more about jazz than any country in the world. They really are jazz lovers, you know, and I tell you, I've never had this experience. I mean, it would be beautiful to have this experience in my own country, but I guess that's not the way of the thing. But, I mean, just to have the experience of just having people just dig you for you and dig you for your music and want your autograph. I autograph pocketbooks. I autograph shirts. They come in with stacks of records. I just never had anything. When I would go to catch a train, every time we went to catch a train, somebody would be there for autographs. You know?
That's true.
Is like, it's just one of the most unbelievable experiences. I think I lived, you know, I live and die quite often, so I lived then, you know, it's weird. I came back here, I died. But then I went and I did a lecture at Rutgers, and I told them about Japan. And it was weird, too, because it was like three pianists, Billy Taylor, Patty Bowen, and myself. And we each would play. Billy Taylor started out, and, you know, give a little bit about yourself. And so it went along good, and I was the last one, and it seemed like they wouldn't even let me come off the stand because I told them about Japan and how beautiful it was, you know, and how really, I guess, I don't know. We have a lot to learn. Maybe it's because they're so old and have such a culture. Maybe it's because they want people to, you know, that kind of thing.
Was there a specific age span of people who seemed most interested in
young?
Young.
Can you imagine that? Young? And like nowadays, it's really odd here in the United States. You might find somebody 30 who doesn't know about jazz at all, see?
Well, there aren't, like on the radio stations here, there aren't. Well, in Philadelphia, there's RTI, which is the Temple University College Station, which pretty well plays jazz throughout the day.
Yeah.
But there certainly aren't, there were formerly, but there aren't now any commercial radio stations specializing in jazz.
I know, it's really changed. Well, you know, I'll tell you, be truthful. Don't give anybody the impression that jazz was ever popular. Jazz was never popular, you know. Like, jazz would have just had its spot. But when we were young, well, there were so many great jazz musicians in different cities, like you can see by the number of jazz musicians Philadelphia produced. The two cities are Philadelphia and Detroit, you know. I mean, for producing good jazz, and that's because of the good, just local jazz musicians around who could play, you know. Well, now we have the little bit of jazz that is being played, a lot of it, is young musicians who have been governed by Downbeat magazine. They've told them who is this, and half of them think that jazz began with Coltrane, which is a mistake in itself right there. Because if you think Coltrane had anything to do with Prez and Coleman Hawkins and them, you can forget it, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, he might have had his niche, you know, or whatever you call it, but it didn't begin with them. It didn't begin with Pharoah Saunders. Well, see, I can see why most people go to rock and roll, because some of the jazz that's played is enough to make me want to listen to rock and roll myself, you know. Even though one thing I notice about rock and roll, one thing I really don't, I worry about it, is that it's weird when you travel all over the country and you find all the people doing the same dances, same singing the same lyrics to the same rock and roll tunes. And it got to be a case where I went in a restaurant. I used to go in every day, and I say, I'm going to check and see if these tunes come on at the same time, and they come on at the same time. See, I don't like that, because that sounds like programming, and that sounds like possibly the robots of the future aren't going to be robots that they make. It's going to be human robots, because this is what it's adding up to now.
Well, a lot of jazz musicians now, and I don't know whether it's through their own wishes or through their producer's wishes, are playing
the rock thing.
Rock
too.
And funky.
Well, you know, half of them say
electric guitar, and not electric guitar, but electric bass. And,
yeah. Well, you hear all kind of excuses for why they do, but we do know really that basically why they do is money, you know. And I mean, well, that's where I try to distinguish myself. I've never really gone after money. I've never made any money in my life, you know. And, well, I consider that the artist part. You know, I don't mind the suffering as long as I can play what I want to play.
Mm-hmm.
And try to do it as best I can, you know. And it's like, you know, the reason I came here today is really strange. You know, I feel like I'm supposed to be connected with Philadelphia some kind of way, because I'm steeped in the best of jazz, you know. And I mean, my ideals in my head, which I have never been able to attain myself, are governed by what I heard in person, not what I heard on records, by hearing Charlie Parker in person and having the feeling that only Charlie Parker could produce in you, the feeling that started in your toes and went all up over you, and it was just like almost orgasmic, you know, that kind of thing. And played with Prez, you know, and played with a whole lot of these people. And from this, it's like, and listen to Bud, and, you know, from this, it's like I am part of like what might be a loss thing, you know, because there aren't that many musicians my age. It's like they were wiped out some kind of way, probably the Korean War and dope or whatever it is, but that's part of it. But see, I feel like I'm supposed to have something in Philadelphia. I've always felt that in my life, you know. Even though I've just played in Philadelphia a few times, and not very successfully. Some success. I played here with Cannonball at Gleason's. Is that it? Was that Gleason's? Is that a place called Gleason's? Peps. That's what I'm trying to say, Peps. Mm-hmm. And then I played at the Showboat, and I've played at the Blue Note. I played the Blue Note with, I was here for Clifford Brown's funeral.
You'll be playing in Philadelphia on May 10th.
May
10th,
I'll be at the Painted Bride. A little very small place, but I know, of course, there should be about 3,000 people. They don't see but 90, but we have 3,000 standing outside cheering and hustling to get in, you know, that kind of thing. It would be beautiful to see that, you know, but I mean, I don't know what has happened with our country. The only thing I can see, you know, like our Japanese country, I can understand it, because the country has such a culture that goes back such a long ways, and they're one people. That's something important. Like, we are a conglomerate. We know that far as history is concerned, probably our country is the one to write about now, because our country is history being made, because we have to get together, we as like people, so that for once, if we could just come up with something that we could consider culture, like what jazz now is. Weird, jazz is considered cultural, our culture, all over the world, but here in the United States. You know, and this is like a sort of horrible thing, really, in some kind of way. Why it should be considered in Europe? It's weird. I had to go to Japan to pick up a record of mine that they haven't released in the United States. which probably won't sell that much in the United States anyway.
What record is that?
Oh, it's one called Vicissitudes. You know, and it's a good record, too. It's got a lot of original tunes. And I did it with George Duvivier and Leroy Williams. And I had to go to Japan to pick up my own record because they don't release it in the United States.
What label is it on?
It's on a German label, BASF, MPS or something like that it's called.
Oh, BASF certainly distributes in America.
So, you know, this kind of thing is sort of disheartening, you know, not to, to say the least, really, because, I don't know.
Is there jazz being produced by Japanese musicians? That's,
oh,
that's
yes. Well, no, I tell you, I went into some clubs, and really, it's really weird. The ones I heard, they sounded better than American young cats playing jazz. So it's like they're really trying to get tuned into it. They're really trying to get tuned into tuned into it right, because they're talking about Bird, and they're talking about Art Tatum, and they're talking about the right people. See, and that's the people you got to talk about. And as far as our music is concerned,
in Philadelphia, there's a lot of avant-garde jazz musicians from New York who often come in to play at the Foxhole. Often affiliated with the Jazz Composers Orchestra. There are people playing that kind of jazz in Japan now.
Oh, there might be some avant-garde boys too. But see, you know, like most avant-garde boys, I mean, it's so weird, you know. See, I've been around New York quite a few years now, and there used to be a place over on McDougal Street where a lot of young musicians used to go and play. I used to drop in there occasionally, and half of them couldn't play. But now half of those same cats who couldn't play then are considered great avant-garde cats now, and they couldn't play, see? So you see, avant-garde is a lot of B.S. Sereni, because these very cats, and if I started naming off names, people would say, oh, you know, if I would just name one name that I know of, cat who couldn't play in the first place, so he can't. The only way we're going to get an avant-garde is going to have to be somebody who can come through all of it. And you see, you evolve into growth. You don't wake up one morning and say, I'm going to put my pants on backwards. That's not necessarily, you'll be different. But that's not necessarily evolving into something. I'm talking about evolving from. We have to come from to evolve into. You know what I mean?
What musicians who are playing very contemporary stuff do you like now?
Well, I'd say if I was going to take one, I'd take McCoy, because that's sincerity, that's humility, and that's it's beautiful qualities about McCoy. It's not even that it is, I have to listen to him, and I have to say that maybe I just, well, just not my stick, but I have to listen to him because I dig him so much, you understand? And I know that he is diligent, you know, that kind of thing, where there are some. You take a cat like, I'll name one. You take one like Herbie Hancock. Herbie Hancock started out making Watermelon Man years ago, and he made a fortune off Watermelon Man. You know, now if a cat can make Watermelon Man and make money and be interested in making money, how can he be considered avant-garde particularly? You know, it's something sort of phony about the whole thing, really. You know, and then all of a sudden it's the rock thing, you know. So they make all the money, but they're still just really phony cats because they haven't stuck to this great thing that was left for us. See, we have a great heritage. And I mean we as Americans. We have a great heritage set forth by Art Tatum, Prez, Coleman Hawkins, Yard. These people, I mean, you can name off a lot more than that, you know, but these are my main ones. And the Monk, you know, these people set a thing that we have to, it's like anything else. When you go to school, you have to learn words. The same thing, when you come through this, you have to learn the words of the music, and they come from these cats. Mm-hmm. Now, when you come out, you say the words your way. That's good, but you had to come through that. So now I can't consider most avant-garde cats or the rock and roll jazz musician who's making the money. I can't think too much of any of them because it's not involved with money. It's involved with love of, you know, it's involved with something else entirely.
For our young musicians who are first starting to play now, the only way to really hear that tradition is through recorded albums.
And you know what's funny is that they don't get a chance to hear it, so they don't even know. See, that's just it.
What do you mean they don't get a chance?
You think about it. A young musician, he'd be lucky. You'd find a young musician would be lucky to have heard a Bird record, maybe. Think about that. Because don't too many radio stations play them. And see, now we, you know, we also live in an age where old folks don't like to be old folks. See, and that's what's the drag about our country, is like we've got the old folks wearing the high heel shoes and the floppy hats and this feminine looking stuff that they're putting out for us, you know. And we've got old folks who don't want to be old folks. Now, we had old folks who wanted to be old folks and stuck to their gun, who did their dances, so that the young person could see their dances, you know. Because I can't consider no. I mean, if I think about the dancing when I was young, I know the dancing nowadays, there's no comparison between them, because the dancing, when I was young, there were people who danced so good that if the drummer turned the beat around a little bit, they'd stop dancing. If the drummer played, if you played a ballad, they'd double time. If you played a real fast tune, they cut the time. People, these weren't musicians, these were just people. So you can't, there's no comparison between that dancing and this dancing of the day. This robot and all that kind of stuff. And plus, the main thing wrong with all of this stuff nowadays is that, you know, I played a dance not that long ago with a musician. He called me, and so it's a gig. And so we played a rock and roll beat all night long, but nobody danced. But you know when they danced, one cat say, oh, I know a tune that they know. The minute he played the tune that they knew exactly like the record, they got up and danced. So that's a drag, because in other words, the dancers are dictating that even the rock and roll cat can't be creative. Mm-hmm. They don't want creativity. They want you to play the same thing. And see, this is not supposed to be. And dancers are supposed to be more creative than that. They're supposed to be creative enough to dance to anything. You
right,
know,
I guess the same kind of syndrome is if you're performing and all right. Everybody wants to hear is what you've already recorded.
Right, same yeah. thing. That's why a jazz musician catches the devil. He might make a tune that's a hit, you know. So pretty soon you make five tunes that's a hit, and pretty soon you have to play those five tunes every night, every set, because the same people aren't there for the set before. So you end up playing it. I did it with Cannonball. It's really weird. We did a week of shows in at the Apollo, and we went to Washington. This was with the Ray Charles group, you know. And so we had played that tune, the hit tune, on 66 shows. And the 67th show, Sam Jones said, look, if you play that tune this time, I'm quitting the band. We didn't play the tune, and we got just as much response as when we played it. It's really weird, you know. So things are really strange that way. You have to be really careful of this hit tune things, and it's so weird, you know. Like, there are supposed to be more hipper young people, but I can see why it's not, because there's nothing really. We aren't giving them the hip, and when the old people are trying to be younger, it's really a drag. So the whole thing is sort of funny. And then when you read about people. You read about, we have music now that kills flowers. You know, they play it so loud that it's known that it kills flowers. They had an article in the paper about some people walked out of a club, and this is more than one person, and they couldn't hear. And they found out it wasn't temporary. It's permanent. They will never hear again because of this loud disco rock and roll stuff. Now, this kind of stuff. And plus, we read about high-heeled shoes. We see more people walking around on crutches. We see people with teeth broken out in the front. And also, we know that high-heeled shoes are bad for a man's prostate gland. Now, if a cat can't dig, that it's bad for his prostate gland. I mean, that's where his being is, you know. And, I mean, no telling what he's messing up there. And, you know, what you going to do when you got people like that? Yeah. We got people who will limp across the street to be in style. We got old people who don't want to be old, you know, and stick to their thing, you know. So it's a weird country right now.
I'm speaking with Barry Harrison. Barry, let's take a break here and listen to your album with vocalist David Allen, also on Xanadu Records. I think it's a really beautiful recording. Can you tell us a couple of words about David Allen?
Oh, well, you know, my first time hearing David Allen, I was so gassed by him. I consider him probably the greatest singer, because he did an album of tunes with old folks who live on the hill, and I never heard of the cat before, you know. And I've been impressed with him ever since. And so this was an opportunity last year in February, I went out and I made this recording with him, you know, and it was a gas.
Okay, this is a recording from the David Allen album featuring Barry Harris on the piano. It's called Don't Look Back. ¶¶
laugh and forget this affair. Guess I was foolish to care. I'm gonna dance you right out of my dreams. Try to act carefree and gay. I guess I'll learn to play the part. And when our friends begin that heartless rumor, then I'll really need my sense of life, make it a beautiful joke. No one will know you broke my heart. And if you find that you and I really meant that last goodbye, then I'm gonna laugh so hard I'll cry. And if you find that you and I really meant that last goodbye, then I'm gonna laugh so
we just heard from the album Don't Look Back. It featured David Allen, the vocalist, and Barry Harris, of course, backing him up on the piano. And Barry Harris is in the studio with me now. The album, by the way, is on Xanadu Records. It must be a very different experience to be backing up a singer of such soft and beautiful ballads. You must really have to be very, very subtle in your playing.
Well, we had to. I guess we practiced for a couple of days, you know. And because I've never done that before, and I don't think he's ever done it either, just a pianist and a singer, you know.
Well, that's what I really loved about the album, because when it came in and I noticed that there was just you playing with him, I said, that's going to be really nice.
So, you know, we worked on it. You know, these most, and plus they were mostly his tunes, like original tunes I never heard before, really. I didn't know any of them. We just got together and we just did it. Well, I did a few things out there, because I did one with Sam Nodo at the same time. And with David Allen, and plus with alto player
Sonny Chris,
you know, I did three things out there for Xanadu, you know, and then I came back and did my own. But this is a nice album, David Allen, you know, nice quiet listening, you know.
You do your own arrangements for the album?
Yeah, well, this is just like we just play, you know, we just improvise, and that's what we did. He sung the melody, and we just went along with it. You know.
Your album of Ted Dameron compositions, was that your idea to
well,
put that together?
It's partly because me and Don had talked about that, been talking about something like that for a long time, you know, since Ted died. And that's where we agreed, you know. It's not that anybody tells me exactly what to play, because I'm sort of funny that way. That's why I probably never made it, you know. But we agreed on this, and I didn't mind playing Ted's, because I respect Ted very much, you know. Ted was one of our greatest writers and arrangers, you know.
Am I mistaken in thinking that not too many people now are recording his compositions?
Well, you know, it's a thing now. Most people are recording their own compositions, you know. That's where we run into a difficulty, too, because there are composers and there are improvisers, you know. And not everybody is a composer, and not everybody is an improviser. One man can improvise on somebody else's stuff, better than he can write and improvise. You know, it's sort of funny writing for yourself sometimes, you know, because you do write for yourself and it gets sort of weird. But not too many people are playing Tad Dam. There are a lot of reasons for it, because I like to put a lot of originals on my records, because you can make a little money off of it too, you know, and see that way. That's what a lot of people do too, you know. So it is a thing. But I just did this one because Tad is one of my people that I loved as a child, you know. And not that he was that much older than me or nothing, but he's one of the people I listened to as I learned.
I had something else I wanted to ask you about, about Japan again. Yeah. And if you're just tuning in now, Barry Harris recently came back from Japan, where he got a really outstanding recognition there. And what kind of places have jazz performance in them? Is it performance places or clubs? It's mostly clubs
in the States. No, it's performance places, you know. And they have clubs there where I went to hear jazz musicians, you know. But they have, like every city had a beautiful concert hall with a beautiful big Steinway in it, 9-footer, you know, which was the gas all the way around, you know. I don't know if I, when it comes to concerts and clubs, I'm a cat. Like some jazz musicians say, they don't like to work in clubs. I don't mind working in clubs. I love working in clubs or a concert, you know. If I can get tuned in, you know, any of it's all right for me, you know. But I don't know, Japan's just a special place, I tell you. It's just really, it's sort of disheartening when you get back to the United States. You sort of get next to you a little bit because, well, you know, a strange thing is this, is that out of all the time, even walking the streets of New York City, I've had about, on 5 occasions, I've had people recognize me and say, "You're Barry Harris," and they were Japanese.
Really?
Honest to God. So, you know, so I knew it was something happening in Japan, so I just found out the truth. And that's the truth, you know. See, because there's a lot of people who would know the difference between Barry Harris and anybody else. So I walk around hiding all day, you know.
Well, you'll be playing in Philadelphia on May 10th at the Painted Bride Center, which is on South Street. That's a Monday evening. There's jazz every Monday night at the Painted Bride. Who are you going to be playing with?
Well, I'll have my own trio, a drummer named Leroy Williams and a bass player named Hal Dotson. And we've been playing together, we work together every Sunday at Bradley's, one night a week.
In New York City?
Yes, in New York. That's on University Place in the Village, you know. Nice place. And we'll be here, I think it's for 2 shows, 8 and 10, right? 8 and 10. So I know it's going to be at least 5,000 people in this little place. I don't know how we're going to get 5,000 in this place. The seat's 90. But we'll get them in some kind of.
Okay.
Sure would be something, you know, for once. I mean, it would be something to find some people who would be interested in. It would even be nice to have a few rock and roll people come so they can hear what some real jazz sound like, you know.
Is it a very different experience for you when you're playing with your own trio than when you're playing, for instance, on a recording day? Yeah, with Sam Noto or Sonny Criss?
Yes, it's a difference, you know. I find that right now, as I've gotten older, I prefer trio work most of all, you know. That way I can just stretch out myself, you know. And I do prefer it most of all, you know. It's a difference nowadays than it was before. You know, like most horn players you played with before could really play, and there's a lot of horn players who can't play, and it's just a few who can, and you don't get a chance to play with them that often. And so my preference now is tending towards trio, you know.
Okay, and Barry Harris will be here with his trio May 10th at the Painted Bride. I want to thank you for coming to WUHY today. I've enjoyed meeting you.
My pleasure.
And we'll hear another excerpt from the Barry Harris Plays Tad Dameron album. Again, it's on Xanadu Records, and this composition is called Kasbah. Thank you very much, Barry Harris.
Thank you very much.
We've been listening to Barry Harris's recording of the Tad Dameron composition Casbah, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY FM in Philadelphia. My guest in the studio now is Marcello Hazan, who's the author of the classic Italian cookbook, The Art of Italian Cooking and The Art of Italian Eating. Let me tell you a little bit about Marcella. She lived in Italy until 1967. She received her doctorate, two doctorates, I believe, at the University of Ferrara, one in natural science and the other in biology. When she moved to New York in 1967, she began giving cooking lessons in her home. As I said, the book is about the art of Italian cooking and the art of Italian eating, and I think we'll we'll move right into this by talking about the art of eating Italian food. You mentioned in your book, and I wasn't aware of this, that the midday meal is the biggest meal in Italy.
Yes.
And that most of the places shut down.
Yes. Everything is closed. You know, the school closed, the children come home, the husband come home, and I think that is the moment that all the family gather around the table. Also in the evening they gather around the table, actually. The meal in Italy is a very important part of the family. And meaning that the meal in Italy doesn't have a main course, but has a sequence of courses. So that is not a rush thing. So the people can have more chance to talk each other.
It's always been my feeling that if you eat a really big meal in the middle of the day, that it kind of slows you down after you've finished eating the big meal. I guess that doesn't happen to you.
Well, because, you see, the very difficult part is that the Italian meal is different what the Americans think about Italian meal. We have a very small portion. It's not oversauced. It's not over-seasoned. And so instead of eating, like, I see many person going to the restaurant and eating a roll of bread with butter, and in the meantime they wait for the first course to arrive, then they already have 2 tablespoons of butter. In Italy, you have a small portion of pasta with very little sauce, because in Italy we eat the pasta with the sauce, not the sauce with the pasta, I keep saying, you know, because it's oversauced, that. And I'm sure that all in your sauce, maybe you have a quarter of a tablespoon of butter there, your portion in your dish. And after you go to the meat or poultry or fish or what it is, and also that is very little season. That we never cover the natural ingredient with many sauce, you see. The sauce is only for pasta.
Well, you refer to pasta as what comes first, a small
yes.
little portion. I mean, my encounters with pasta have been the main course.
Yes.
After salad and bread, you get this enormous plate of spaghetti or
that
something.
That is what I'm trying to help the people to understand about Italian food, that you cannot eat Italian food in the American way. You have to eat Italian food in the Italian way to really enjoy it. That is why I said it is an art of eating.
Well, you say in your book that, as you just said, that there's not one main course, but there's usually two principal dishes.
Two principal dishes, yes. One first course that can be a dish of pasta, or can be a rice, or can be a soup. Always small portion, I keep repeating. And after you go to the second course, meat, poultry, or fish, or game, or something, organ, anything, small portion also those. And one or two vegetables cooked in many different way, because we cook the vegetable in many different way. And that we have a small portion of salad that doesn't have at all the Italian dressing that they have in America, because in Italy doesn't exist an Italian dressing.
What kind of dressing do you use?
Well, I can tell you one thing. We have a proverb for dressing a salad. This proverb said that to make a good salad, you need 4 persons. One very just for the salt, one very generous for the olive oil, and good olive oil, one very stingy for the vinegar, and one patient to toss it. That is your salad dressing. So you see, it's very simple.
Now, does the salad come in the sequence that you just gave it? After you've eaten everything else, then you eat your salad?
After we eat the salad, because you see, meaning that the salad is usually some green, fresh, and raw, and with this very simple dressing. For us, it meant to wash your mouth from the taste that you had before the food. And after we have usually fruit. We don't have many cakes in Italy.
You don't have a large piece of cheesecake afterwards?
No.
or a spumoni or a tortoni, which is classic fare in Italian-American restaurants.
That is American, Italian-American restaurant. You pointed out very nicely, and you help him in that. Because, you see, we have cake. They're home cake that we do at home, but they're very seldom done. They're for a special occasion, for Christmas, New Year, for a birthday, for a special dinner. Like, we never served at home appetizer. You know, Italian cooking, the best is home cooking. It's not a restaurant cooking. Also in Italy.
Okay, now I eat differently at home than I do when I eat out. I mean, when I eat out, I might have an appetizer and a dessert, which I certainly won't go through the effort to do if I'm eating home. And I'm wondering, in Italy, you mentioned this whole sequence of events. Does it happen the same way at home and in restaurants?
Yes, of course. Of course. What will be kept out at home usually is the appetizer. And you know why? Because many times the appetizer take a place of a second course of the lighter meal that Italy has, that is in the evening. Like if you served some kind of cold cut, you know, some prosciutto, some salami for appetizer, sardino, or some artichokes Roman style that is a very well-known appetizer around Rome, sometimes it is a part of a second course in the light meal in the evening. So usually you don't have appetizer in Italy. And, you know, in Italian, appetizer is antipasto. And if I literally translate the word, you will understand. It's before the meal. Doesn't belong to the meal, really. It's something before the meal. Anti is ante, you know, everything is before.
Mm-hmm.
Pasto is a meal.
What about breakfast? I mean, you hear about French breakfast and English breakfast. I really have no conception of what an Italian breakfast would be.
Italian breakfast is very simple, almost doesn't exist. You know, the family, they grow up, usually they take a coffee, the kind of coffee that America is called espresso. In Italian, the espresso in what you have in the, between, with this big coffee machine that they go by steam. And sometime with some milk, maybe the youngest, they have some kind of toast with butter or just the dip the bread in the café and milk, coffee and milk, what the French call café au lait. And so the breakfast really doesn't exist. I think that is the reason why we have the biggest meal on lunch hour.
Mm-hmm. And the evening meal?
The evening meal, usually you have a soup because it's lighter. And after you have maybe some kind of frittata that is an Italian omelette or a fish that we think that is lighter to eat, usually and always cooked vegetables because we cannot live without vegetables and we cook it in so many different ways just because we wanted to have it in different way because we get tired of having the same dish. And fruit that is the fruit of the season. Sometimes you marinate this fruit. Sometimes you do something with this fruit and put a little cream, whipped cream or something, if there's strawberry or wine or anything, but like repeated, no cake. So in this way, you see, if you eat the Italian food in this way, you hit 3 points. One is that is a very balanced diet naturally, because you have a little carbohydrate with your rice or pasta at the beginning, a little protein with the meat, all the mineral and the vitamin that you want because you have a lot of vegetable cooked and uncooked with the salad. You save your budget because if you have a small portion of a first course, usually the second course, that is the meat or the fish, is the most expensive one.
Right.
But you are already a little satisfied on your table, so you don't want to have a big steak or a large portion of fish, you know. And so you are satisfied with the small things that usually cost less if it is a small piece. And the vegetable, usually they're not very expensive. The fruit, also they're not so rich.
You say in your book that the vegetable kind of defines what the rest of the meal is going to be, and I don't understand that.
Well, you cannot find very fresh asparagus for Christmas, no? So you are not going to make a meal with asparagus in Christmas time.
Oh, I see. So if the dish you have in mind depends on asparagus.
Yes, so now you know that the asparagus, now they are here. No, so you find that the meat, a recipe for the meat that go along with the asparagus, and the recipe of the meat, that you have to have also the recipe of the first course that go along with the second course. Because you see, if you have a first course that is very spicy, very strong, and you go in some second course that is very subtle, very delicate, both dishes, they can be very good, but one doesn't go with the other one. So you ruin the meal. So I think it's some kind of... everything has to be in tune. I like to call a meal, Italian meal, some kind of orchestration, because, you know, everything is in tune. You have act that is one course, and after you have a kind of intermission, and after you have the second course. And I think it's a very pleasant way of eating.
I have to ask you a candid question. Do you ever eat New York City pizza?
No. I try it, and I start it.
What do you think of it? You don't like it?
No. I don't. Sometime I found a pizza that has a very good dough, you know, the bread part, and the tomato, they're horrible. And sometime the tomato, they're not bad, but the dough is very bad. And I'm surprised. Anyway, pizza is something that in Italy we eat outside. Because, you see, to make a very good pizza, really, you have to have an open oven, a wood fire oven, but open.
You mean you bake it outside?
No, you go to a place that is called pizzeria, like here, right, you know, to eat the pizza, because they have this kind of oven. With the floor in the corner is the fire made by wood.
Mm-hmm.
And the floor is made by tile, and the pizza is put on the tile that they're very hot. So the way of cooking pizza supposed to be that way. And it changed completely. And they cook very, very fast.
Do you ever eat in Italian-American restaurants?
Not much, no, if I'm not forced to.
Okay. I'd like to talk about different Italian cheeses and ways to use them. How can you recognize, like, a fresh piece of Parmesan cheese? If you're buying it, you know, if you're not buying Kraft-grated Parmesan cheese.
Well, that I would advise no one to buy it grated, because it's not grated 2 hours before. And when the Parmesan cheese is grated, lose all this flavor. And I advise everyone that wanted to have grated Parmesan cheese to buy it. Sawdust. It's cheaper, has the same taste.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't taste anything, Parmesan cheese grated from a long time. So I advise it to choose a good Parmesan cheese. First of all, the Parmigiano Reggiano is supposed to have on the crust on a little dot written Parmigiano Reggiano. Second, you taste a piece, and after you wait a few seconds, and if you are left with a cheesy, nice taste in your mouth, you had a good Parmesan cheese. If you had a cheesy but bitter taste, you hit a very bad Parmesan cheese. So if you really need it at that moment, buy a small piece. If not, you buy a big piece and you can keep it for a long time. Wrap it in aluminum foil on the bottom part of the refrigerator and cut it a piece that you need, and you grate it when you need it. And if it starts drying, that you see around the crust, it's getting whiter.
Mm-hmm.
So take it out from the refrigerator, take it out from the aluminum foil, and put a cheesecloth just humid, very, very little, you know, water in, just squeeze out all the water. Wrap it around the on top of that the aluminum foil, and keep it a few hours. But after, when you took out both wrapping, let the surface dry, because you cannot wrap it on the aluminum foil and put it on the bottom of the refrigerator and not have mold if it's not the surface dry.
Mm-hmm.
But in this way, reassume the moisture and you save the piece. The Parmesan cheese belong from the north part of Italy, because the north part of Italy has the bigger plain, so has a dairy farm. That is why we use butter. It's not because we are near France. It's because we have the cow. With the cow. And is a milk cow. On the south, we don't have many plain. And the land is much rough, much more hard. And so we have the Romano cheese because it's a goat milk cheese.
Oh, that's the difference?
Yes, that is the difference.
No, if I go to my local store and buy Romano cheese, it's going to be made with goat's milk?
Well, it's supposed to be made. I don't know your local what will do, but it's supposed to be goat milk. And that is why the taste is so different, because it's much more stronger.
But is it used? Do you think it should be or could be used the same way, Romano cheese as Parmesan cheese?
No.
What's the difference?
Well, it's a difference between one mellow, subtle taste to one very spicy and very strong taste. So their recipe is one recipe in Rome that is called Bucatina alla Matriciana. Matrice is a place near Rome, and that is why I give the name. And as between the other ingredient, you use a little, very little Romano cheese and Parmesan cheese, both. If you go more in the south, naturally, more the recipe they call for Romano because it's the local cheese. Mm-hmm. So they use it more, the local cheese, and they're more spicy. Also because the south of Italy is hotter. So usually, every region, when is the climate's hotter, they have spicier food, so you can drink more, you know that.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, now, what about ricotta cheese? I've seen some people in recipes substitute cottage cheese or farmer's cheese for
ricotta cheese.
Yeah.
Well, no, they're two different things. Ricotta cheese is much more creamy than what is cottage cheese. And also doesn't have any that little acid taste that cottage cheese has
mm-hmm.
or farmer's cheese has. Farmer's cheese also is no creamy at all.
Right.
So they're not substitution, but they're not what you mentioned, Parmigiano, Romano, and ricotta. They're things that in an Italian store you're supposed to find it. In my tour here, I found it all over. They have it. It's not that it's really a problem.
Mm-hmm. From the way you're talking about the different regions and how they use different cheeses and stuff, I guess that the Italian styles of cooking are really determined from where you came from in Italy, and that it's not Italy as a whole does not have a specific style of cooking, but each region within it does.
You are perfectly right, because Italian cooking, just Italian cooking, doesn't exist really, because you see, Italy is a very young nation. It's younger than the United States. It's a little over 100 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Before, they were all little state republic and so on, that they were fighting each other like mad. And really, they were not going to see what they were cooking the next one. So they built up their own cooking. That is one of the reasons. The other reason is the climate that is so different. You can go in Piemonte near Turin, and you have a very cold winter, freezing, like Copenhagen. You take a car and drive just 100 miles, and you reach the Italian Riviera with all the carnation blooming the same day, practically. And in Sicily, it's different. And and also the sea is different. The Tyrrhenian sea is the one through Spain is deeper and saltier. And the coast is rocky. The Adriatic is much less deep and less salty, not only because it's less deep, because also receive the bigger river that Italy has. So it's less salty, and the coast is sandy coast. So what you catch there is different than what you catch in the other part. And you can be both in the north of Italy, and you cannot have the same fish soup because you don't have the same fish.
Well, you're going to be taking classes of Americans to Italy for cooking lessons. Which part of Italy are you going to position yourself in?
In Bologna, that is recognized like the gastronomical capital of Italy. You know, also the Italian, when they think about Bologna, they think about food, not art, painting, something like that. And my object is to show to this America how the Italian live with the food, the relation that they have, the people and the food, how they decide to market, how they cook. Because real Italian food is so easy, is that to do that. It's so misunderstood in this country. that I would like to show them. It's very easy. We could not make two meals, three courses each meal, if it was not very easy, don't you think so?
But when I think of really cooking an Italian meal, I mean, doing it all from scratch, that to me means maybe making your own pasta, which to me means spending a lot of time making the dough, rolling it out so that it's very thin, cutting it up, letting it dry, then first cooking it.
First of all, you mentioned pasta. Making your own pasta, roll it out by hand, this is not a recipe, this is a craft.
Uh-huh.
So when you learn to do something, you do it in 15 minutes, or 15 minutes is not a long time, because after you save the time in the cooking, because you're cooking only in a 3 or 4 or 5 seconds. When you put the pasta in, the moment that you get in the boil, the pasta is cooked. So the time that you saved on the cooking, you put it on doing the pasta. But that doesn't mean that you have to have your Italian meal with the pasta every time. And also, you can have pasta, what we call store-bought pasta, that is a factory-made pasta, like spaghetti. You never make spaghetti at home in Italy, no? You buy it.
Mm-hmm.
This is a factory. It's a thing that the factory does, spaghetti, macaroni, rigatoni, penne, all those things that are in the box. But also, you can do a dish of spaghetti. The time that the water boil is 10 times the time that you can make one sauce that is very known in Rome, that is aglio e olio. It means oil and garlic. You just chop the little garlic, put it in a hot olive oil, and don't make the garlic take color because it's too strong. Just lightly leave the white part, no? And put it on top of the pasta that is cooked, that is your famous Roman sauce. So you see, it's very easy.
Mm-hmm.
It's you take any spinach, parboiled, you pass it one moment in a butter, sprinkle with Parmesan cheese, you have your vegetable done. It's take a scallopine. To make a scallopine and marsala, you don't have to take 5 minutes. If I do 2 recipes, talking and discussing the recipe in TV, and they give me sometimes 15 minutes from the scratch, I think that it's not difficult.
Really? Well, okay. Well, I imagine your students will be doing a lot of cooking as well as a lot of eating once they go to Italy.
Oh, my students also in New York. My big reward is what after they take one course, they said that they don't go anymore in the Italian restaurant. Not only that, but this cooking that they learned became natural part of the family. What I mean is not for a special occasion or someday they do it.
Mm-hmm.
Normally they do it.
Right. Okay, I've been speaking with Marcella Hazan, who's the author of the classic Italian cookbook, The Art of Italian Cooking and The Italian Art of Eating. Marcella, I want to thank you very much for coming by today.
Thank you.
And in a few minutes, we're going to be speaking with John Aiello, who is the executive director of the Italian-American Bicentennial. But right now, we're going to listen to an excerpt from the new Rahsaan Roland Kirk album. And what we'll hear, I think, refers back to what Barry Harris was saying about musical tradition. This is a Charles Mingus composition called Goodbye Pork Pie Hat, which is written for Lester Young, and Rahsaan Roland Kirk has written words for it. We just heard Rahsaan Roland Kirk's version of Charles Mingus' composition Goodbye Pork Pie Hat, which was written for Lester Young, and Rahsaan Roland Kirk wrote the words that he was singing. He was featured as the vocalist. You're listening to Fresh Air. This is WUHY FM in Philadelphia. And my guest in the studio now is John Aiello, who's the executive director for the Italian-American Bicentennial. We're going to be speaking about the Italian-American Bicentennial in a few minutes, but first, John, I'd like to ask you about some of the views that you hold. There's an article here that is reprinted that I'd just like to read a couple of paragraphs back to you and have you explain what is meant by this. According to Aiello, the realities of global Italian geographical placement, the combination of resources and influences, become the tools with which to utilize our Italian advantage. He sees the future in terms of a compatible linking of a new temporal organization with our spiritual situation for the first time in global Italian history. The end result is an indispensable Italian leadership role benefiting all the world cultures who have joined with Italians in the past and will again. First of all, can you explain to me the idea of Italian global leadership?
Well, the point of that article is to point out the fact of the geographic placement in America. The Italians in America, numbering around 22 million, are positioned in places in key industrial states. Now, whether the Italians take advantage of their political, economic base power in America is a question in the future. The placement of Italians in Canada, in South America, which there are at least 22 million, a commensurate amount of Italians in South America, and of course the standard one of Italy with their own sphere of influence thing in the Mediterranean. Now, whether a people at a given time begin to see when the time is right, their resources, both in terms of sheer people power by numbers, a monetary power, their economic influence in key areas, and place that with the resources of their problem-solving mechanism, which would be the young and the older people with the professional ranking and that kind of experience, whether they start to pull those human resources and political, economic resources together to make a statement in a period of time in which we see when we study history that at points in time the world actually looks towards those groups that have a particular ability to respond to a problem at a given historic period. And this would be the potential of Italians, the leadership potential.
I may be misinterpreting what you're saying, but I see it two different ways. Sometimes when you were speaking, I thought that you meant that Italian-Americans should really, especially if they're in positions of power, use their power and their education and influence to help the Italian-American community. But other times when I was listening to you, I thought, no, maybe you're really looking for a world that is more highly dominated by Italians, and I really don't know what you mean.
No, it's I don't think any individual that represents a group in the beginning, if you were head of a family in a block, in a community, you would naturally be looking towards the welfare of your own family in the house, but knowing that your house is not alone, you'd also be attending meetings and trying to keep the community in some kind of rational balance. So you can, as you're part of the community, the whole community is healthy. I think blacks, Lithuanians, Jews, Italians, Chinese, all the ethnic groups in this country have to look not only to their own welfare, but the fact that they're not separate in that sense. They're separate. What I like to say is they're separate but connected. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes we connect too much and lose the separation, and sometimes the other extreme, of course, is being too separate, in which we lose that kind of a brotherhood of a connection with people. So the thing is here that all groups like yourself, in the sense of an individual, have to know who you are, that therefore you function better in the world, that asks you to know who you are every given day and what you want. And then also is responsibility in that participation to do things and have priorities that are for the general welfare.
What problems or situations do you think are unique to the Italian-American community at this time?
Well, the situation that's unique with the Italians at this time is the fact that it's an emerging group that has, if you look at the history, the major influx has been a little in 1880, but really in 1920. So the Italians in this country have been here, let's say, 50 years. Now, my father was born in Italy. My mother, half the family in Italy, half here. So it's been, and then they moved into heavily ethnic areas. So you can almost say it was an ersatz Italy, little Italy's, things like that. And as they emerge of just learning how to speak a language in a northern country, for the first time minority group, you know, you leave one country, you're Italian in Italy, and then you come to America and you're just an Italian like a lot of other groups in a big new country with a strange language and a whole new history. So it takes an amount of years for the people to get jobs, be accepted, prove their value, which I think, by the way, there's a human kind of prejudice in the sense that I don't think anybody lived next door to you. Immediately the first day they were on the block, you're going to tell them what you have in the bank account and start sharing deep secrets. You know, after you cultivate them and understand that they can be trusted and you feel more relaxed with them, you start to share information with them, then you bring them more into your purview, your cosmos that you have. So I think Italians here 50 years have proven that, you know, they work hard. They certainly have the abilities, both in their labor and in their intelligence, to be extremely respectable in the sense of the making of America. And studying the history of Italians in America, it would point out that they've been very influential in a lot of key areas, which are not known too much. But this will emerge. To answer your question, the whole point that this is a new kind of energy which will bring all this out, you know, how they can participate even more.
How have you resolved for yourself the idea of assimilation into America, of keeping ties to Italy, which is your original country? And well, no, you were born in America?
Yes.
Yeah, right. Well, but still you feel
South
ties.
South Philly,
right. You feel ties to Italy. How have you resolved
that?
Well,
this is a problem. This is a big problem of duality and ambiguity for a lot of people. Remember, we come out of a situation in America where America had to tell everybody to kind of calm down in an area and realize there was an America and don't be so tangentary with your energies. Then when the country's more secure, I think you can, it's working for somebody that's insecure, they want you to be more like them so they have control. Sometimes a boss that is a little bit more open with his own ability to understand himself will allow you more flexibility to expose your own individuality. And I think now America's at the point where it actually has to allow this to occur, this individuality. The duality of... if I read my 40th book on Italian culture, I in no way, by the Declaration of Independence, abrogate my citizenship. The Catholic Church has an interesting thing called dual allegiance, that you can be a Catholic as you can be a Jew or a Protestant in any country. That as long as you follow the rules and go along with what the essence of a nation is, and especially in America, that would say that you actually did come here to obey laws, but to be who you were. A lot of the interpretation, which really is an interpolation of the Declaration of Independence, is that we came here to be the same Americans. The real point is that we came here to be free enough to be different, with nobody trying to mold us the way they've molded us in Europe over the years and stop maybe some individual potential from coming out of that you know, kind of need to want to problem solve in your own way. So the church says you can be a Catholic or a Jew or a Protestant, and I think you can be an Italian, a Jew, a Lithuanian, an Irishman in America, and explore your culture with all the freedom of that and still be American. And in fact, I think it's the only way to be American if you so choose to do that. Here's a question of choice. Are we allowed to do that? There are many people that don't want to do it, and I think it's fine if that's their choice, but I don't think their decision to not pursue it necessarily has to put a handcuff on me or anybody else that believes in keeping contact with your culture.
I know you've organized meetings with Greek, Armenian, and Jewish groups. Is this the kind of thing you talk about at those meetings?
I've always had close contact. When you come from South Philadelphia, you automatically, the contiguousness of the neighborhoods made it almost imperative that you almost were thrown into it. I lived in a borderline of a Jewish community, an Italian community, with Irish nearby, always very close to Greeks and Armenians. So as you grow up in that atmosphere and you choose to do that kind of cultural work, it's just obvious that you get to know more and more people from those groups and try to talk out. I think it would be very good if more of the groups in the city, the key leaders of these different backgrounds, would get together more and talk about their joint problems rather than dealing totally with their own. Sometimes when you deal too much with your own, really when you deal with a further problem, you handle your own problem inadvertently.
I read, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you were trying to get financial assistance from the Italian government for Italian Americans?
You mean for the bicentennial?
Oh, is that for the bicentennial?
No, the bicentennial. Oh, I have a lot of projects working with. I have land in southern Italy. There's some projects I'm dealing with. An enormous amount of Italian Americans in this country are southern Italian. So I feel there's a responsibility to try to make that attachment with the culture that they come from to better understand how they're functioning in this country or any other country around the world. Italians have always been world citizens. Columbus did work for Spain, Verrazzano for France, Cabot for England. So it's always been a natural kind of problem-solving energy of Italians all the time, too, and especially when Italy's only been a country for 120 years. What are those Italians? How are they Italians before a nation? So they've always had that openness with a lot of various cultures. One of their prime works during the Renaissance and ever since then was to pull the Occidental, the Oriental, the Arabic, the Hebraic, the Hellenic, that whole Mediterranean basin, which is very close to Camus' views on the Mediterranean man. And Italy has always been part of that structure. Its very geography and bloodline would indicate that.
You are the executive director of the Italian-American Bicentennial. And before we start discussing some of the events that are planned for the Bicentennial, Mayor Rizzo is the honorary chairperson?
Chairman, yeah.
Chairman, yeah. How do you feel about that now that there's a movement to recall Rizzo afoot? How does it feel to you to have a person who is actively being sought for recall by many Philadelphia citizens be chairing the the bicentennial?
Well, I think it's absolutely consistent when I said that if I can be an Italian in America, that we're looking for those energies. Mayor Rizzo feels strongly about being Italian, and so far as his participation in the bicentennial, I think it would be accurate to say that he's proud to be Italian, and he's proud, by the way, to have his administration support all the ethnic cultures. I don't think a lot of people in the city know that this city administration has granted funds in the midst of a monetary crisis, which is endemic in this country and around the world, that the administration of our city has seen fit to help over 30 separate ethnic groups. And Mayor Rizzo not only has a feeling for his own Italian background, but I think for the backgrounds and the perpetuation and protection of all the cultural heritages in the city. So I'm very happy to have his help, and I see his own private business and political business
his political business his private business, or does it become that in terms of the bicentennial?
I don't see any, crisscross here of energies. I think I answered your question. You know, this is, I'm not a politician. I don't see it. I would say, no, there's no problem at all. We're happy to have his help. And I think the city should be happy that he's helped a lot of the different groups achieve a lot of their programs in this bicentennial.
Okay, what are some of the programs that are planned for the Italian-American bicentennial?
Well, we start May 9th with the people in Philadelphia should be proud for a lot of the great things we have here in the different cultures. As far as the Italian culture, we have the first Italian-American church in America, 7th and Montrose, St. Mary Magdalene de Pazzi Church. And Cardinal Kroll will be a concelebrant at a special pontifical mass on May 9th, which is Mother's Day. And there'll be a procession, a Holy Eucharist procession. And we'll have that night at Philadelphia Music Academy, we'll have at the Schubert Theater, special composers of Italian background, Italian-Americans, which will have their work. Alfred Drake will be there to recite some things. And we go right through the month of May. There's another Super Sunday, the Italian Market. And we're also very close to bringing the famous Italian circus from Milano to Philadelphia. The Italian Market is sponsoring this, along with
do you know what date
the Italian
that will
Bicentennial.
Be?
Yes, May 21st to June 13th, the circus will be here. And the big art show at Memorial Hall, special art show, which John Facenda will be master of ceremonies during the opening. May 10th is the official opening of the thing. Munir Society, Mandolin Society, Drama, American Institute of Italian Culture with excerpts from La Boheme. So we go through the whole month of May with... And Thomas Pasitieri, who's had a tremendous amount of publicity in the Philadelphia papers and the New York Times recently, a tremendous article in the New York Times 2 weeks ago, will be flying in from Chicago especially for a premier local performance by the Rittenhouse Opera Society. Marco Farnese is director of that. He'll fly in especially for three one-act operas repeated two nights, the 14th and the 17th of May. So the month of May is a very special month, and there are a lot of activities I think a lot of the people will be interested in. And if they have, the people listening, have any need any information, to just pick up the phone and call us at the office. We'd be glad to send them our brochure and all the information.
Okay, you're welcome to give the phone number.
923-8485. That's 927 South 8th Street.
Okay, thank you very much. I've been speaking with John Aiello, who's the executive director of the Italian-American Bicentennial. Thank you. And we're going to hear now another excerpt from Steve Goodman's new recording.